across. Everybody knows the war is over. Everybody knows the good guys lost.
Welcome to the Lifeboat Hour, Friday, May 15, 2015, as we rapidly approach the halfway mark of this year. Wow, is it just me, or is everything speeding up? Well, in fact, some things are speeding up, and we're going to talk about that with our guest today, because most of us can't even grasp how quickly humans are rendering this planet uninhabitable. We seem to set a new record every month for warming temperatures, extreme weather, ocean acidification, and polar ice melts. When we really do grasp this, we're not going to be able to deal with it on an intellectual level alone. In fact, if we try to stay in our heads with this, our hearts, our bodies, our souls, and maybe even our lives will explode. I'm not speaking literally here, but rather symbolically, in the sense that more science, more reason, more facts cannot possibly help us cope with the current and future global crisis. Paradoxically, we must intelligently pay attention to our feelings. Intelligently pay attention to our feelings. And before we move into conversation with today's guests, I want to make a couple of suggestions about how to pay intelligent attention to our feelings. So last night, it was my great honor and privilege to come together online with a group of people who really want to go deeper into their hearts and emotions as they face the global crisis. I'm talking about a webinar that I have the great pleasure of co-facilitating with my friend and colleague, Francis Weller. The webinar is called Grief and Joy in a Flatline Culture. It began last night and will continue through next Thursday night, May 21st. This webinar is an excellent opportunity to begin the conversation and the experience of feeling our grief about our predicament. So if you'd like to register for that webinar and get the recording from last night's session and join us next Thursday night for the second and concluding session, please visit www.syncast.net. Now that's spelled www.syncast.net. How many places in this culture offer us a safe place to feel and share our grief? This webinar certainly does. So please consider joining us. Again, the website location for registration is syncast.net. Now, obviously, when it comes to feeling our grief, there's only so much we can do online. So I want to let people know about a natural next step from the webinar that you can take to further explore and experience your grief with great safety and support. And that is a weekend workshop that I'm facilitating June 12th through 14th in Providence, Rhode Island, in which many people are coming together in a beautiful place in nature to feel and celebrate our grief. When I facilitated these weekends in the past, I've always been amazed and really blessed to see people supporting each other in grieving and deeply connecting with each other in the process, and also hearing many people telling me that when they really allowed themselves to feel their grief, they discovered that they felt much more alive and joyful than they had ever felt. So to learn more about this weekend, you can visit my website, carolynbaker.net, or just email me at carolyn@carolynbaker.net, or send me a private Facebook message. So as we approach the midpoint of 2015, we must note that in March, for the first time since record-keeping began, carbon dioxide levels have surpassed 400 parts per million globally. That's according to a newly published study that came out for March. Now, CO2 emissions are the main driver of climate change, and those have risen more than 120 parts per million since pre-industrial times. The planet has warmed 1.6 degrees Fahrenheit over that period as well. Now, this is according to the Climate Central website, where science writer Brian Kahn notes, quote, "The 400 parts per million milestone is largely a symbolic one, but the new global data, which comes courtesy of the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, serves as an important reminder that while CO2 emissions stabilized in 2014, that's not the same as dropping to zero. As a result, CO2 continues to pile up in the atmosphere," unquote. Now, our guest today is going to tell us more about this latest development and also illumine the topic, not just with more science, but together he and I are going to delve deeper into the areas of psychology, spirituality, grief, and what I believe are the root causes of the predicament in which we find ourselves. I'm guessing that our conversation may resemble the dialogue between Guy McPherson and me in our 2014 book, Extinction Dialogues, How to Live with Death in Mind, but certainly with some differences. In fact, I believe this conversation is one that we should be having everywhere. My guest is investigative journalist Dar Jamal, who, as many of you know, is a staff reporter for the Truth Out website and is the author of The Will to Resist, Soldiers Who Refuse to Fight in Iraq and Afghanistan, that was published in 2009. He also wrote Beyond the Green Zone, Dispatches from an Unembedded Journalist in Occupied Iraq in 2007. Dar also reported from Iraq for more than a year, as well as from Lebanon, Syria, Jordan, and Turkey over the last 10 years, and has won the Martha Gellhorn Award for Investigative Journalism, among other awards. His third book, The Mass Destruction of Iraq, Why It Is Happening and Who Is Responsible, co-written with William Rivers Pitt, is available now on Amazon. He lives and works in Washington State. I'm deeply honored to have as my guest today Dar Jamal. Dar, welcome to the Lifeboat Hour.
Thank you, Carolyn. Good to be with you.
So, Dar, on April 27th of this year, Truth Out carried a fabulous article by you entitled Cataclysmic Changes as Planetary Temperatures Rise, in which you wrote extensively not only about the record that was set in March, but also about the many planetary distress signals that are coming in increasing volume. And you call all of this anthropogenic climate disruption. I'm wondering if you'd spend some time summarizing those distress signals, because I want to lay out a context specifically for our discussion. And also, would you explain the term ACD?
Sure, I'll start with that. I chose to use that term, anthropomorphic climate disruption, because, you know, one of the arguments of the climate deniers is that, well, the climate's always changing. You know, and you know, technically you'd have to agree that, yeah, that is actually a factually accurate statement. The climate is changing every second of every day, always has been, always will be, no matter what happens. So if we talk about, instead of using the term change, climate disruption, because what humans have done by injecting so much CO2 into the atmosphere and literally changing the chemistry of the atmosphere and hence causing these massive disruptions on the planet is precisely climate disruption. And then, of course, simply using the term anthropogenic, using one word instead of two, which means the same thing as human caused. And so that's why I try to use that term just to be very, very accurate, as I do in all my climate dispatches, including all the links to all the scientific reports, because as you and I are going to get into soon, the information is so intense and our situation is so dire that I've taken it upon myself to be increasingly specific, more of a layperson's term is just being really, really anal about how intensely I document things and make extremely specific citations and only use the most credible and highest level scientific reports available. So that's the explanation of anthropogenic climate disruption as a term. And then, you know, the planetary distress signals that we're seeing there's several. And really, I think the first and most important one is the increasing acidification of the oceans. We're seeing more and more reports on this now, and the reality is that once we change the chemistry of the oceans to a point where they can't support the building of coral reefs, where approximately 90% of all life in ocean spends some time of its life in a coral reef. Once those stop being able to be formed, then it doesn't take a genius to see how that's going to dramatically impact life in the oceans. And so that's one, I think, probably the most important aspect. We're already seeing the fact that because of overfishing and pollution, mass die-offs in the ocean are already well underway. Over 90% of all the pelagic fish in the planet are already gone, just for starters. And we're seeing growing dead zones, an increasing of them both in number and in size, all around the planet, not just, you know, in the Gulf of Mexico that we hear about in this country, but all around the entire planet. Other signs, I think the second probably most important distress signal is what's happening to the poles, specifically the Arctic, where we're seeing just actually a report came out last week that showed that in the satellite era, we just saw the winter of the lowest recorded ice volume in the Arctic on record. So the Navy a ways back released a report that they predicted a ice-free Arctic by 2016, and it looks like we may well be on track to start seeing periods in the summer of an ice-free Arctic. So once that goes, then, of course, that's a major positive feedback loop, because then we're going to see increasing amounts of heat trapped in the dark water there, as well as then, of course, this ramping up the heating around the rest of the globe. So so as not to go on too much longer about this, that's really, I think, two of the most important things, and maybe we can get into some of the others a little bit later, but those are, I think, the two most obvious, blatant, and I think the most critical distress signals that we're seeing to date.
Well, it's interesting. This just popped into my mind. I hear you're going glacier climbing soon. And if so, listeners might like to know about that. Any truth in that?
Well, it's true. I do mountaineer, and I am actually starting climbing season right now. And I live up in Washington State, so I'm fortunate enough to live nearby some really beautiful areas. And I think, you know, I'm making it a point to spend as much time up on the mountains and on glaciers as possible, because another report came out just a couple of weeks ago that showed in Canada, for example, the entire country of Canada is expected to not have glaciers by 2100. So
wow.
It's another way of, I think, appreciating what's here while it's here as part of this process that I think you and I are going to be talking about today. And I think that's a really important part of it.
Yeah, indeed, we will be talking about that. You know, I think it's so important to visit these places, experience these places while we still have them before they're gone. And so, you know, I certainly understand why you want to do that. Now, another question just came to mind, which is the whole thing about shell drilling in the Arctic. You know, the timing of that is pretty interesting now that there's almost no ice there. You know, they're going to go in. Do you have any thoughts about that? What that's going to do?
Well, this is, I think, it's a situation that's almost, it's really unbelievable to see. When you look at what's happening in the Arctic already, as we just discussed, and
right.
The fact that they're now basically racing up there as fast as possible while the ice is even still there, and start doing drilling and exploratory wells and getting ready to exploit that region for resource extraction of resources that should in no way, shape, or form even be extracted and burned in the first place, because it's just going to speed things up anyhow. So it's really, I couldn't possibly be more opposed to these efforts of drilling in the Arctic, both by Shell and other companies around the world. And it's not just this country. Of course, every country that has a border on the Arctic, including Russia and Scandinavian countries, are all doing the same thing. Is another reason why we're seeing major upticks in U.S. Navy training exercises up in my part of the world, as well as further north up in Alaska. It's all geared towards the race for what's left in the Arctic.
Right, absolutely. Well, you know, humanity at this juncture seems overwhelmingly unwilling to face reality. We're in full-on ACD, and clearly there seems to be very little chance that ACD can be reversed or even slowed down. So the question keeps coming back to what Guy McPherson and I have written about in depth in our book, Extinction Dialogues, How to Live with Death in Mind, which is, how are we going to live the rest of our lives in the face of anthropogenic climate disruption? I know that for you, this topic involves the five stages of grief, and I'd really like you to expound on all of this.
Well, it does, and I've written about the five stages of grief in relation to this topic extensively because I've personally gone through it, and I think it's just the fact that every person on this planet are going through it in relation to ACD, whether they're aware of it or not. And, of course, that would be another one of the stages of grief, of denial, for those who don't think they are. But, you know, it's a situation where I've watched myself vacillate from anger to denial to bargaining to acceptance and then to depression and then cycling back just consistently in and out of those phases. And, you know, I think right now I'm in a situation where I kind of vacillate, you know, often still between these different phases. And it's really, I think, important for all of us, first of all, to just acknowledge clearly what's happening on the planet, how the fact is that we are already in abrupt climate change, and that we need to accept that. We need to understand how far along we are. We need to look at what that means. We need to look at the fact that we are already well into the sixth great mass extinction, and our species is certainly not going to be left out of that in the long term when we look at how devastating ACD is to the planet and how, you know, today is better than tomorrow. It's only going to be getting worse with time, not better. And that's a hard thing to accept. And so I think when people are faced with this, for example, this is when I've written about, this kind of puts the climate denialists in a different perspective where we kind of laugh at them and mock them and call them climate denialists. But in reality, these are people who are insistent to the bitter end of remaining stuck in the denial phase of the Kubler-Ross five stages of grief. And then, of course, we can look at other areas of denial comes in the form of, you know, keeping ourselves preoccupied with electronic devices or, you know, the fluff you see that poses as mainstream media these days and other ways that people use to be in denial about the gravity of the situation. But I think it's just critical, I think, to find other people to talk about what's happening and start processing our feelings around it so as to be able to get out there and be active and talk about what's happening and alert other people to what's going on and start living accordingly because, you know, life is short. We know that even if this crisis wasn't happening right now, and we need to live and behave accordingly in that context. And we are literally unable to do that unless we've taken in the grief, acknowledged the situation, process through the feelings, and continue to do the work that we need to do on a daily basis to be able to stay present.
Well, I could not agree with you more, Dar. And, you know, there's one little term that I'd like you to just say more about. It may seem minor, but, a lot of people don't understand what abrupt climate change means. And, of course, that obviously it means it's going to go fast. But can you say more about that, abrupt climate change?
Yeah, it basically does mean what you just said in that we, you know, so many people think that climate change is a linear process and that, you know, we, for example, are now looking at, we're permanently over 400 parts per million CO2 in the atmosphere very, very shortly. And that's only going to continue to increase. And so, you know, a lot of people think, well, things are going to keep kind of slowly lopping along, and we're seeing this slow, constant increase in temperatures, and, you know, we are going to be losing more and more glaciers, and temperatures are going to keep rising consistently and slowly over the planet. And so as that progresses, you know, a lot of people think that's going to be in a linear fashion, but in reality is we are already in abrupt climate change, and even NASA scientists are talking about this. So instead of talking about the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, the UN body, the IPCC, that's really probably the most heavily cited and the biggest group coming out making climate change predictions. Their worst-case scenario of temperature change by the end of 2100 is 3 to 4 C. And reality is we're talking about abrupt climate change, looking at we could hit 6 C by 2050. If not sooner. And if we look at the temperature records being broken now on an annual basis, both on a planetary scale as well as regionally and even locally in a lot of cases, we are seeing evidence of that. Again, look at how fast
the Arctic ice sheet is melting. So many people thought, well, this is going to be a 2050, 2085 thing, and no, actually, we're looking at starting to see ice-free periods in the Arctic, probably starting as early as the end of next summer. And then that, of course, is another positive feedback loop, as Guy McPherson has written about, that basically just ramps things up even faster. Therefore, the Arctic starts absorbing that much more heat, that therefore it starts staying melted, melting earlier and staying melted later in the season, to where probably as little as a decade from now, we'd be looking at an Arctic that has no ice in the summer at all. So we're looking at these abrupt changes happening, ocean acidification speeding up. Everything has consistently outpaced the IPCC worst-case predictions as far as sea level rise, as far as ocean acidification, as far as temperature increases globally, and just about every other category that they track. The reality has consistently outpaced their worst-case predictions for over a decade and a half now, and that only continues to speed up. And so all of that is to say that there is ample evidence in front of our eyes right now that shows we are well into abrupt climate change. And so we're not talking about 2100 until things start to get really, really bad. We're talking about as early as 2020 and certainly 2030 at the latest.
Well, you know, as you were talking, I was thinking about being a child in the 1950s in the throes of the Cold War and constantly hearing about the nuclear threat, constantly hearing about, you know, Russia's got this many nuclear warheads and we've got this many, and constantly having this fear hang over our head until people became very psychically numb. And I believe that's a similar case in talking about abrupt climate change, that we're hearing about it so much, people are really, I think, starting to become numb. So for that reason, every once in a while on the Lifeboat Hour, I have to play a song that takes us to a place of poignancy, a place where beauty and sorrow meet in the sounds of one of the most extraordinary pieces of music I've ever heard. And I don't think it will take you long to recognize this music as the music of your heart, as you witness, as we all witness, the destruction of the planet. So as we listen, let's drop all the words, all the science, and just allow ourselves to feel. Here's Paul Winter's Wolf Eyes. That was Wolf Eyes with Paul Winter, and this is the Lifeboat Hour. I'm your host, Carolyn Baker, and today I'm talking with Dar Jamal, investigative journalist, author of several books, and one of the most important climate writers of our time. If anyone is not familiar with the work of Dar Jamal, you need to visit his website at www.darjamal.net, and that's spelled D-A-H-R-J-A-M-A-I-L, all one word, .net, and read his articles at truthout.org. Dar is an extraordinary tracker of anthropogenic climate disruption and not only records the research, but connects the dots regarding what ACD means for the Earth community and what it means for all living beings in the time we have left on this Earth. In a few moments, we're going to open the lines for callers, and I ask you to please call us with a question or comment for Dar. The number is 888-874-4888. We very much want to hear from you. This man that I'm honored to be talking with today really, really gets it about abrupt, catastrophic climate change, and he's eager and willing and waiting to hear from you with your comments or questions. So call us at 888-874-4888. Dar, as you know, in our book, Extinction Dialogues, How to Live with Death in Mind, Guy McPherson and I talked about planetary hospice and the possibility that we've been admitted to it, whether or not we realize that fact. I'd like you to talk about this kind of soul-searching and how we might live in the limited time we have left.
I agree with what you and Guy wrote about that idea of us having entered into that phase, and feel that way myself, and kind of briefly touched on that subject earlier, talking about the need to, I think, get out into nature as often as possible, and whatever capacity it is that we enjoy it the most, of getting out, appreciating what's there while it's still there, whether it's nature or wild streams and lakes or things like that. Where, you know, just getting out and really appreciating it and being out in it. And I think that's also a really, really helpful way for us to process feelings that come up around that, you know, is really getting out and appreciating the grandeur and majesty of nature, as well as giving ourselves a chance to kind of breathe. Because I think living amidst all the distractions of mainstream society today make it almost impossible to really be real about what's happening and have our feelings. And I think, obviously, time out in nature is where we can find solace, where we can recharge, and as well as really process through a lot of the feelings that come up around the fact that, you know, like for me personally, I just got back from a trip in Alaska and did a hike out towards a glacier and went up to the toe with a friend, a local who'd been living there for several years, and looking at this big lake at the terminus of the glacier. And he said, yeah, you know, last year, that was 10 feet thick of just solid ice, you know, the toe of the glacier literally coming all the way down. And now, you know, it's a big lake that you would literally need a boat to go out into. And it's just things are melting and changing that fast. And so I think it's also important to get out and see with our own eyes what's happening. And, you know, you don't have to even go too far to really see whether it's if you live in Southern California or even, well, all of California at this point, and to see the drought firsthand, other places around the country, other evidence of rivers that don't even reach the lakes or the oceans that they used to drain into anymore, or something as dramatic as glaciers melting. So I think that's another aspect of it that it's really, you know, our processing of what's happening has kind of helped along when we go out there and see it firsthand and can actually be with it.
Yeah, and you know, for me, I don't just go out there to see the devastation, although I think that's really important. But I go out just to, you know, I've been talking lately about this developing Earth intimacy and developing this kind of sensuous relationship with the Earth. And what that does for me is help me feel the way I am the Earth, you know, that I'm not separate from it. And so I'm kind of curious, like, what do you experience when you go out into nature besides seeing the devastation? What's it like for you?
Well, for me, you know, most of the time I go out now, it's to climb mountains, and which always, of course, involves backpacking and camping as well, and oftentimes covering large distances. And You know, it's really, literally, I mean, almost as an aside from what we're talking about, it's a way that I recharge my batteries, and it fills me back up. And, you know, I spend all week in front of a computer writing usually about really, really devastating and emotionally difficult stories about how fast this is happening to the planet and, you know, species die-offs and more extinctions and, you know, vanishing glaciers. And, you know, this stuff's really, really challenging to take in. And so I think I'm able to keep doing it consistently, helped in large part by going out every weekend, usually with friends, going up to places where, you know, for me personally, mountains are like my church, and just getting filled back up, you know, and appreciating the perspective that I get from being in nature about my real insignificance, you know, in terms of the planet, that, you know, we, in the grand scheme of things, we are, you know, in no way, shape, or form the primary species on the planet. I don't believe that idea that we're at the top of the food chain or any of that. And I think that, you know, you can't help but be reminded of that when you go out and try to climb a big mountain or, you know, something happens in the wilderness and you have to deal with it if it's an emergency situation. And just, you know, going out there also for humility, you know, and the humility that comes and being in that kind of majesty and that kind of power and really, you know, kind of realizing our right place in the world, as opposed to, you know, mainstream society has us, well, we're the apex, we're the top of the food chain, you know, we're going to find some technological fix and get our way out of this and all of that. So it's another way where I get perspective, but also to, you know, recharge my batteries. And again, just really, really appreciate, you know, how amazing this planet really is and the things that and what it produces and how beautiful it is. And I think that's critical because also, if I had to point to one single factor as to what caused climate disruption to go on and why more people aren't acutely aware of it, as well as why more people aren't really doing what they can to try to mitigate it at least a little bit, it's the disconnect that, at least in Western society, has from nature, you know, a disconnect of getting out on a regular basis and appreciating where we came from and the environment that we live in. You know, because as a friend and colleague of mine, Derek Jensen, has written about, if, you know, when we turn on our taps to get water and when we go to the grocery store to get our food, then those are the systems that we rely on, and those are the systems that, if they're threatened, that we're gonna fight to protect them. But conversely, if we rely on a nearby stream for our water and we have to go out into nature to find our food, then that's what we're going to care about, and that's what we're going to work to protect. And I think that disconnect from the latter is a big part of the problem that's led us to where we are today.
Well, thank you for that. That's just amazing. I love it, and I'm totally with you on that. Listeners, we'd love you to call and talk to Dar, to ask him a question, to make a comment. The number is 888-874-4888. And I'm going to do something a little different here than I don't usually do with guests. But, Dar, you said ahead of time that you wanted to ask me some questions about some of my books. So we can certainly do that, and I'm open to hearing what you'd like to say about that.
Well, I did request that, Carolyn, because you have another book that's come out on this topic. And I think, just like you said at the beginning of the hour, it's a topic that isn't talked about nearly enough, and certainly has a long way to go before it starts becoming more mainstream. I think eventually it will, but I think you're so far ahead of the curve that I wanted to ask you some questions about it. And just what, you know, what in general are you referring people to do, or suggesting people to do to, A, start taking in the gravity of the situation, and B, you know, what are some of the suggestions you're making that people should be doing in their lives during this time?
Well, thanks for asking that. Yeah, that's what all of my books are about, and especially the new one, Love in the Age of Ecological Apocalypse, Cultivating the Relationships We Need to Thrive. You know, certainly people should start with the basics of gathering information and find out the research and learn about what abrupt climate change really is. But many of the people who come to me for life coaching have already done that, and maybe they've almost done it too much because they're kind of relying on that, you know, like they're kind of relying on, well, if I get more information, if I accumulate more facts, you know, then that's going to validate, you know, my position. Because we do live in a world where we've got this knowledge, and as you said, lamestream news doesn't give us a clue about these things. And so we carry all of this knowledge by ourselves and carrying it around in our bodies, and we're isolated with it. And so oftentimes if we don't really have people to talk to about it, then we're sitting in front of our computers and gathering more, which really is just, over time, it just fries us, I think. It certainly fries our hearts. And so, you know, I think we have to really get back to this whole notion and reality of relationship. And what I do in this book is I take 16 different relationships, because everyone and everything in our lives is a relationship, and I talk about how do we deepen these relationships. And, of course, the very first one I talk about is living, loving, and preparing with a reluctant partner, and how do we talk to family members, and how do we talk to our children, and so forth. But also I have a chapter in here on the earth, you know, and about falling in love with the earth all over again, or maybe for the first time. And that's why I was talking about what happens to me when I go out into nature, and this whole thing of my senses and my heart is opened, and I love what you said about humility, that we begin to really see our place in the world and have perspective. And I also love that you kept talking about feelings, because people are in so much grief right now. And they're carrying this heavy, heavy load. And one of the reasons that I have, you know, this theme song that I have for the Lifeboat Hour, Everybody Knows, is because I believe, on some level, everybody does know what our predicament is and how really severe it is. And so for this reason, I'm doing a lot of grief work right now, individually with people and in these workshops. And that's why we have the webinar that started last night, so that people begin to have safe and supportive places where they can feel this grief. Now, some people say, well, why feel your grief? Shouldn't you be out there being an activist, doing something? Absolutely, by all means. But I believe very strongly that our activism has to be informed by love, so that we will be love in action. And the only way that can happen is if we open our hearts, if we feel our feelings. And grief is the greatest emotion right now that many of us are feeling. And so feeling our grief does a number of things. It opens our hearts. It reconnects us with the earth and with each other and with ourselves. And paradoxically, feeling our grief deepens our aliveness and our passion, and also deepens our joy, because grief and joy travel together. Grief increases our gratitude. There's so many ways that grief is good medicine for us. And so that's kind of the big focus, Dar, that I'm placing right now on in my work.
Thanks, Karen. I think that's really, really amazing and critical at this point for all of us to think about. And I certainly would encourage folks to pick up your new book, which I've had a chance to read. And it's really fabulous and extremely helpful, because I think, first of all, just really getting a clearer idea of kind of the emotional and spiritual landscape of where we are, because this is a very, very new place. You know, we've never been here before as a species. And so, you know, I write about and talk a lot about what does that mean physically, as I did the first half of the show, really. Mm-hmm. What does it mean physically to be in this place and be on a planet that this is happening to? But, you know, it's you know, just as importantly is what does this mean now emotionally to us and spiritually as beings, and how do we cope with it, and how do we adjust, and how do we, you know, it's because it literally, we have to kind of live our way into, I think, a new consciousness and a new way of being and seeing in this age that we've not been prepared for. And certainly it's something that we're being completely dissuaded from doing by the mainstream media and mainstream society, where it's just, hey, don't, you know, everything's fine, it's going to be okay, there's going to be some techno fix, keep trying to make money, keep buying things, keep distracting yourself, it's all fine, don't worry about it, we've got it under control. And the reality is absolutely the opposite. And so right. I think that's where, you know, your work and you and Guy's book, The Extinction Dialogues, I mean, all of that is really critical. And it's kind of counterculture stuff right now, but I think just like how consciousness is slowly starting to shift, even in the mainstream, about the dramatic aspect of ACD. I think that you and Guy's work and your work specifically on this topic is pioneering work, and I think it is just a matter of time before more folks, being the mainstream society and mainstream media, start to kind of catch up and are forced to report on it because of how dramatic the situation is continuing to become.
Well, thank you for that. And, I just want to let people know that our book, Extinction Dialogues, How to Live with Death in Mind, is actually being reproduced. And so we have a new edition coming out this summer. It's going to be, much improved from the last one. So I want to let people know that. And I also wanted to ask you, Dar, do you have people in your life that you can talk about these things with honestly?
Fortunately, I do. My wife and I we see eye to eye on literally all of these topics, and obviously that's the most important relationship in my life, and we are. And fortunately, even both of our immediate families, we don't see eye to eye on all of it, but at least generally, at least even our immediate families do for the most part, see it as well. So I'm really fortunate, and I live in a community where I have several close friends that see eye to eye with me on this stuff as well. So I am lucky for that.
That's great. And I wanted to ask you about your writing because, you actually embody what I call a new kind of journalism. How do you define your approach to journalism? It's such a breath of fresh air.
Well, thank you, Carolyn. And, I've never subscribed to the idea of unbiased journalism or really more specifically objective journalism.
Right.
I was fortunate enough while Howard Zinn was still alive several years ago to get to sit down and have dinner with he and Noam Chomsky, and I got to basically pick both their magnificent brains about what is this idea of objective journalism. And so they basically set me straight on that pretty early on in my journalistic career. So I let that go, and, obviously it's important to report all sides of a story and be fair. But the most important thing is to be accurate, and that means reporting on things exactly as they are. And so when we're reporting on something as dramatic as climate change, I think that means covering all these different aspects, and that means talking to people like you and writing about that aspect of the story, because leaving that aspect out would be a huge omission. And so I think it is a new age of journalism, and it really requires all of us to let go of those old corporate-based myths of objective journalism, or that, you're being biased, and really let that go and kind of mature into being adult and saying, look, writing about these stories entails a lot of responsibility, and a big part of that responsibility at this point for me, writing about the single biggest news story in the history of the species and will continue to be the biggest news story, well, I have to write about that in a way that makes it emotionally accessible for my readers. And so for me, that means a lot of the time in my stories, I need to put myself out there and kind of help people share that process with people of dealing with the feelings that come up from the story. And I do that by a lot of the times taking people through my own journey with the information emotionally.
Well, I so admire that because, that is just the antithesis, as you say, of the whole quote-unquote objective thing where you've got a distance from your story, and you're not really emotionally involved with it. And so the fact that you are is just so amazing. I really, really appreciate that. And I hope that you continue to write on Truth Out for a really long time because we need your voice. And I recall a lot of your articles, maybe 10, 12 years ago where you're writing about the Iraq War. And now it seems like you're more focused in the environmental and the climate change place. Is that correct?
It is. I made a conscious decision back around 2010 when the BP oil spill occurred in the Gulf of Mexico to transition away from the war and veterans issues and more into the environment and climate change. I'd been seeing the impacts myself firsthand since the 90s during my climbing up in Alaska and knew it was a topic I wanted to get into. And then when the BP disaster happened, it was the natural segue. And, of course, as I just said, I mean, what bigger story is there than this story? And I wanted to get into it, not just from a journalistic perspective, but personally, because I'm fascinated by it, and I want to stay completely abreast of what's happening. And there's, for me, no better way to do that than, you know, spending my weeks at work finding the leading scientists on different topics and talking to them. So I'm on the cutting edge of this is exactly where we're at this time regarding ACD, and it's a critical thing to stay up on. And I'm both fascinated by it, but also it's been a way I've been able to kind of get myself ready physically, spiritually, psychologically, and try to stay very much in the loop and stay tuned in to what's going on.
Well, you just, you know, I'm just being spontaneous now. You just mentioned a word that that some people have a difficult time with, which is spiritual. And so what does that mean to you, and how do you relate that to what we're going through now as a species?
Well, I think the first thing I would need to point out is that that does not mean religious. I'm not affiliated with any kind of organized mainstream religion or any religion for that matter. And so, you know, spirituality of, you know, where do people find, get in touch with the great mystery, I would say,
or,
you know, things that they can't understand and can't explain and they're fascinated by, like, where does people's awe come from, that kind of thing. And for kind of a general way to put it, you know, so, you know, things that we can't explain and, you know, where does that come from? So that's really my perspective on it. It's almost more of a pagan perspective than that which from like Western or even Eastern mainstream religions. So I'd make that distinction. I think that's important. I basically view mainstream religion as kind of the bureaucracy of spirituality, and that's, you know, I don't subscribe to it. And I think at the core, all of the major religions have had started off well, but, you know, bureaucracy does what bureaucracy does.
Well, I love the word mystery. I love that you use that word. For me, that's what spirituality is, the great mystery. There are five things that the rational mind and the human ego and the intellect can't really deal with, that I think only the great mystery can help us with, and that is, these are five topics: love, death, suffering, the sacred, and eternity. So, you know, I think we need greater ways to deal with those than just the human mind. So we talked for a moment ago about my book, and I just want to mention a little bit about next week's show, just to let everyone know that next week on this show, I'm going to be focusing on the first chapter of my book, Love in the Age of Ecological Apocalypse, and the title of that chapter is Living, Loving, and Preparing with a Reluctant Partner. In fact, this week I'm going to post on Facebook the first chapter of that book, so that people can read it, and, you know, hopefully it will bring up some questions or comments that people can call in and talk about when I discuss the chapter next week. I have so many folks who contact me for life coaching and for other things that are dealing with not being able to talk about these things with their family or their loved ones or their partners. And so I just want to devote a whole show to that because it's such a huge and painful experience for a lot of people. So we want all of you to join us next week for the show. Tell your friends and call in with your comments or questions. Dar, is there anything else that you'd like to add before we finish up today?
You know, Carol, I think we've really covered it. I really can't think of too much else to add beyond what we've talked about. I mean, you know, big, important topics, other than just, I think it's important for folks to stay tuned into what's going on in order to stay tuned in emotionally and spiritually. I think that's a thought that I'd like to leave folks with because, you know, as hard as this information is to take in, unless we have a full perspective of the reality of our situation, then how can we cope with it internally? So that's just a thought I'd like to leave people with to consider doing and consider to making part of their working lives.
Well, thank you for that, Dar, and thank you so much for being on this show. I've been speaking with Dar Jamail, D-A-H-R-J-A-M-A-I-L. You can visit his website, darjamail.net, and you can read his articles on truthout.org. Thank you, Dar, for being with us today.
Thank you, Carolyn, very much.
And everyone, come back and join us again next week on the Lifeboat Hour, because everybody knows.
Everybody knows the war is over. Everybody knows the good guys lost. Everybody knows the fight was fixed.